Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good. You doing all right?
I'm good. I'm a little tired.
You were scoping out San Diego.
I was.
What's going on out there?
Oh, dude, out there it's going on. If you guys are looking for something amazing to do in October, which I'm sure you are, you should definitely consider go ahead and plan ahead and plan to hang out with me and Chad and a whole host of other people in beautiful San Diego, California. We need some help because we're going to try to invade a resort. So if you'd like to be part of that and help us invade that, it's for a good cause. It's to have a party. So you should definitely come and help us out. So go over to herewestillstand.org. You can see the speaker lineup. It's going to be a big, huge party. Bunch of speakers. It's going to be ridiculous. 2.5 days of, man, we're all going to be trapped in this one little place together, man. And we're going to tear it up. So you can go over there, see the lineup. Everything you need to know is over at herewestillstand.org. But me and Chad will both be there along with basically everyone that you guys can think of that you would want to be there. So check it out. Come celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with us.
Can't wait.
Yeah, bro.
Can't wait.
It's going to be good. It's going to be real good. Speaking of real good, how's the Exodus shaping up?
Oh, Exodus, as we say in Hebrew, is tov ma'od. Very good. We are poised on the brink of one of the best chapters in the Bible. I probably said that about chapter 12, but chapter 14 is pretty hard to beat too, because this is the crossing of the Red Sea. So anyway, we're almost there. We're like, I don't know, 5 verses from getting there. So we're going to pick up with those 5 verses and march boldly toward the Red Sea and see what happens.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so we almost finished chapter 13 last time of Exodus, but we didn't. So we are going to pick up at verse 17 and go from there to the end of the chapter, which is only another 5 verses, and then we'll jump to the whole Red Sea story. So we start out with 13:17 saying, "Now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go." That's more literally when he had kind of divorced them or kicked them out. It wasn't just a letting them go. When he let them go or kicked them out, that God, this is interesting, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was close by. Oh, why didn't he? We have this very insightful comment that follows this. It says, because God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. I find that fascinating. It's like this insight into what God was thinking. So he's brought the people out of slavery, and it's like he has this inner monologue where he's thinking, okay, now we got several options to get them from Egypt to where I want them to be. Now, you know, as the crow flies, the straightest way to get them to the Holy Land would be to let them go along the shore of the Mediterranean Sea and work their way up through the land of the Philistines to the Holy Land. I mean, that's basically the straight shot. It was called the Way of Horus by the Egyptians. This was the path, or the kind of, not really a path, but a like a road, I guess we would call it, through the area beside the Mediterranean Sea that led from the south to the north. And the Philistines lived in that area. There were all sorts of garrisons, military garrisons built along there, little settlements with soldiers for protection, all that kind of stuff. So that was a straight shot. But God knew that if he sent the Israelites that way, it wasn't going to be good. It was going to be really bad, in fact, because they were going to encounter Egyptian soldiers and they were going to have conflicts. And God knew, he says, if I send the people this way, they're going to see war. They're going to be involved in these military conflicts along that particular path, and they're going to go back to Egypt. So God realizes the weakness of his people. God takes that into consideration. It's like he takes into consideration the emotional instability of his people, the fact that they have been weakened by decades, by centuries of slavery, and that they're sinners, just like we all are. So he takes that all into account and says, no, we're not going to go that way. I'm going to bring them by a different way. Now, this isn't his only motivation, but this is one of the motivations. And I found that pretty fascinating. Not as an insight so much into humanity, because we all know people are that way, but an insight into the way that God deals with humanity. I think we tend to think that God is one of those, you know, I'm going to send them this way no matter what. And it really doesn't matter what they encounter along the way. That's just going to be the way it's going to be. But no, God takes into consideration the weakness of his people and our propensity to return to slavery. And he sends the Israelites by a different way. So that's the way it starts out. Not going that way, we're going to a different way. So it says he leads the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea.
We definitely find out that throughout the Exodus and the rest of this book that God's plan is not always like God's GPS is not always the same as ours. He's not like you are on the fastest route. You will arrive at this time. He's like, you're on the route that I have chosen, and it might take a while.
Yeah. It's I've used this proverb many times. I don't know if I've used it on the podcast or not, but it's one of my favorites. Portuguese proverb that says God writes straight with crooked lines. So he's riding straight, but it's with crooked lines. So he leads his people where he wants them to be, but he leads them in a crooked sort of way. It's not the fastest route, like you said. And often it seems as if God is just completely lost, like he doesn't have any idea what he's doing. But he's not. He's taking the Israelites just like he takes us, just where he wants us to be. Only it's usually after we've been there that we realize why he was doing what he was doing. So they leave. And there's a little footnote here that I think is important. It says that they took the bones of Joseph with them. Moses, in particular, took the bones of Joseph with him. Because way back, if you've been with us all these many episodes, you'll remember that Joseph dies, and they embalm him in the land of Egypt. And he gave strict orders to the Israelites that when God visited them, to bring them out of the land of Egypt, that they were to carry his bones with them. And in fact, that's what they do here. That's what they're going to continue to do. We have a couple of other references to this. They're going to carry the bones of Joseph with them out of Egypt for 40 years in the wilderness into the Holy Land and finally bury those bones of Joseph there. So Joseph finally gets home. After centuries of being away, he left when he was 17 years old. So after centuries of being away, finally the bones of Joseph are brought home. These bones are kind of like the, I don't know what you'd want to call them, something like kind of the icon of God's fidelity, if you will. These bones represent God's faithfulness to keep his promises and to bring his people out of not just slavery, but into the promised land. So they got Joseph bones with them. They set out. We have some geographical markers that are given to us here. They leave Sukkot. They camp in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And then we have one more detail before we get to chapter 14, which is going to come up several times throughout the rest of the Torah, but certainly the rest of the story of the Exodus. And that is that God journeyed with his people. God is never a standoff kind of God where, you know, he's way up in heaven looking down through his divine binoculars to see how his people are doing. He's always right there with them. He's the kind of God who is Emmanuel. He's always God with us in different ways in the Old Testament. but he's always the near God, the God who's right there with his people. So he goes with the Israelites in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, these are not two different pillars. It's just the same pillar that looks different at night than it does during the day. So it's like a cloud during the day leading the Israelites. And then at night, it's like this glowing mist, if you will, that gives off light for the Israelites. So they can travel by day and they can travel by night. So this is like the clothing of God, if you will. This is the way that he manifests himself to the people so that they can actually, they can't see God per se, but they can see God's mask. They can see that this cloud has enveloped him. So just as surely as they see that cloud, so surely do they see God himself traveling in their midst. So we're going to hear more about this in just a minute, but this cloud is going to journey with them. This cloud is going to go on the mountain of Sinai when they get there. It's going to go into the Holy of Holies once the tabernacle is built. So this cloud is significant as an indication of the presence of God. And to make a big leap ahead here, that's the reason that on the Mount of Transfiguration, if you remember that story, that a cloud was there and this cloud enveloped Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. And from that cloud, the Father spoke and said, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." Well, this was that's a very Old Testament kind of thing to happen. It was on the Mount of Transfiguration. That was God's way of saying, look, I'm in the cloud. My Son's in the cloud, just like he was in the cloud in the Old Testament. So he's in the cloud now. And of course, this happens on a mountaintop, which harkens back to Sinai. So all of the whole Transfiguration stuff that's going on there has its roots way back here in Exodus. And that's the end of chapter 13.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I feel a sense of accomplishment having finished five verses.
Well, we've been moving at that godlike pace the last couple of episodes, so it's good that we're back on our timing now, Chad. It's good.
That's right. We'll see how long that lasts, right? Okay, so what happens next? Well, we have a beginning of chapter 14 with some more map type stuff telling us where they're at. God speaks to Moses and says, here's what I want you to tell the Israelites. They are to turn back. Turn back. I mean, no going forward. Turn back and camp at this place called Pi Hahirot. Nobody knows where that is, but Pi Hahirot, between Migdol and the sea. And you shall camp in front of Baal Zephon opposite by the sea. Now, the only thing you really need to remember here is that they turn back. They're not going forward. And they're camping by the sea. And the reason this is important is because of what's about to happen next. He says, God goes on and says, because Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, ah, they're wandering aimlessly in the land, and the wilderness has shut them in. So Pharaoh's going to say to himself, he must have, you know, not spies, but lookouts. They're keeping track of where the Israelites are at. And they're going to report back, oh, these people, they don't know what they're doing. They're running around like chickens with their head cut off. They don't have any idea where they're at. They're just like walking in circles, wandering aimlessly in the wilderness. They don't have any idea where they're supposed to be going. It's going to be easy to either conquer them again or to kill them or whatever we want to do. That's the impression that God wants Pharaoh and his officers to have of the Israelites. So God is setting up Pharaoh by having the Israelites do this. Because then he goes on to say this. So I will harden Pharaoh's heart. We've seen that lots of times. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored. That could also be translated, I will be glorified. I will be honored and glorified through Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. And they did so. So that's how we got things kind of set up here at the beginning of chapter 14. God did not bring the Israelites by a straight way. He brought them toward the wilderness, and they had him turned back, and he has him now camped right on the shore of the Red Sea. And he knows that Pharaoh, whose heart is already hardened, and now God is going to strengthen that hardening. God is going to like strengthen the sinful resolve of Pharaoh so that he's going to pursue the Israelites into the wilderness for one final showdown. And the result of this will be, at least here, the only explicit result of this will be that the Egyptians will know that he is Yahweh. That's insightful. It's not only for the sake of the Israelites that God is doing this. It's also for the sake of the Egyptians. So what's about to happen is going to send a message both directions, to Israel as well as to Egypt, that he is Yahweh, that he is the Lord of the whole earth, and that he is going to act on behalf of his people in decisive and saving ways. So that takes us through verse 4. Let's keep moving, see what happens. So the king of Egypt is informed that the people had fled. Pharaoh has a change of heart toward the people. And they said, "What is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So it's after everything that happened with the death of the firstborn, the Israelites, the Egyptians, along with Pharaoh, realize that from their perspective, they've messed up. I mean, this was a major economic loss for the Egyptians because they relied on the Israelites as slaves to do all the work. I mean, this would be like losing a huge percentage of your economy just walking out of the country. So they have a change of heart, and so they decide that they're going to pursue them. So they get ready. Pharaoh, he gets his chariot ready. He takes his people with him. They've got 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. God hardens the heart of Pharaoh. He chases after the sons of Israel. And it goes on to, it's like this is almost overdone because it keeps talking about how many chariots there are and how many horsemen they are. And they pursue them as they are camped beside the Red Sea. So this is the Bible's way of setting everything up to make it appear as if there's about to be a major destruction of his people. I mean, everything points toward this. The sons of Israel have placed themselves, really God has placed them, but the sons of Israel have placed themselves in a spot that is a terrible choice militarily. They have nowhere to go. It's like they've marched into a box canyon, like in the old Westerns, you know, all the shootouts take place in this box canyon. There's one way in and one way out. And if you go in there and all the enemies are behind you, that you have nowhere to go. Well, that's kind of the Israelites. They've boxed themselves in. So they can't, the sea has them trapped. They can't go that way. The Egyptian army is coming from the opposite direction. So they can't go back that way. So there's nowhere they look that they can turn. They're trapped. And everything that they can assume, that they can think about, that they can observe, seems to indicate that this is going to be a sure and certain destruction for them.
When you read about the way that the Pharaoh pursues them, you know, it seems like, man, that's a lot. You know, going after a bunch of people that like really aren't armed, and like, I mean, you're going after them. But I suppose you have to think that if Pharaoh's going after people that just, or at least one guy, who just like brought all kinds of havoc on his land. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't, you know, you assume like, well, I don't know what a military force is going to do against the sort of things that Moses wrought on Egypt. But I guess if you got the chariots and horses, you bring them out. You're like, well, I don't know how this is going to go, but I guess I'll go after him with everything I got because it was gnarly. It was a mess in Egypt. And I don't know what kind of junk this guy's going to try to pull but I might as well have everything I have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's gonna hold nothing back. It's interesting too. I was thinking of this, that this is really the first time that Egypt has gone against Israel in a military fashion. You know, it did happen throughout the course of the 10 plagues. Of course, that happened on Egyptian soil. This is outside the country. So this is the first time that Egypt is going to face Israel as one army against another army. Yeah. He's not playing it safe here. I mean, he's going to give it all he has.
Yeah. And obviously the goal here is not like to bring them back into captivity. He's actually going to go and exterminate them.
Yeah, I think this is a revenge mission, if it's anything. This is to be a decimation of the Israelites, and especially of Moses, because of everything that happened. So what does happen? Well, first of all, there's a slight pause in the action here, at least the military action, because we have to hear the reaction of the Israelites. And it's easy for me anyway to kind of pick on the Israelites. But I guarantee you that if I was one of them in this particular situation, I probably would have been the ringleader of all this complaining and murmuring and crying out that was taking place. And if you think of it from their perspective, they've gone through all of this, this long, long drawn out period of suffering, where they waited for God. He finally did redeem them. And they think now that as they've entered into the wilderness, that everything is going to be okay. And then everything seems to fall apart again. It's almost harder the second time, which is where they're at now. I mean, the first time they thought they were going to be destroyed, then they were saved. Now here comes the second time. And it's like, oh, again. So here's what they say. They cry out to the Lord, but they're speaking to Moses. So it says they cried out to Yahweh, but they speak to Moses. And here's what they say to Moses. Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Isn't this what we spoke to you in Egypt? We said, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, because it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. So this is a lot like the various complaints that we hear in some of the Psalms, the lament Psalms, where the people complain about God seeming to abandon them, complaining about whatever sufferings that they are enduring, the fears that they experience, the persecutions, whatever it is they're going through. Except this is directed not so much to God as it is to his representative, to Moses. And the basic complaint is this, that slavery is better than the sure and certain death that we are about to experience. Of course, that's not what's going to happen then, but from their perspective, it's better to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in these verses, Egypt, the name of Egypt comes up. So this is kind of this is the cry of the sinner wishing that he can return to slavery. It's like when they've been in this prison for so long, they can't imagine freedom. Freedom scares them. Or when they see what they think is going to be a destruction coming upon them. And so they wish that they could return back to the land of slavery. And this is the first of many, many times that they're going to repeat this cry. Why leave Egypt? I mean, it's a good reminder that freedom, as much a gift as it is also so in some ways a cross for the sinner, because the sinner always prefers life behind bars aid of the freedom that God gives.
It tells us also that redemption looks like death, and that's just true.
That's a great point. Yeah, from the sinner's perspective, redemption looks just like death.
Oh, yeah. It looks like death from Jesus' perspective, too. Like, I mean, the when you get delivered, or if redemption is going to happen, you're going to, when God is going to deliver you, I mean, like, there is this thing where, I mean, like, the Israelites are being redeemed or delivered, and they're crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, that's what they, cause that's what it feels like. Feels like that for Jesus when he's actually going to redeem the world. Yeah, it feels like that. And of course, in their case, he hasn't. And in Jesus' case, he has. In a spiritual sense there, but yeah, I mean, I think it feels like that to us a lot of the time. I think when God does finally act, a lot of times in his action, we're like, why have you abandoned me? Which is kind of backwards, and that's just how God is. When he's actually moving and doing things, for some reason we feel very alone in that. It's funny that, I mean, while they're in Egypt, they're crying out to God, have you forgotten us? Have you forgotten your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Have you abandoned us? And then he delivers as soon as he delivers them, they're like, have you abandoned us? It's almost like, have you abandoned us? This is just like the cry of the Christian, like, in this world.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great point. It doesn't matter where we're at, whether we're beginning the Christian life or we're almost at the end of it. That really is the cry. I mean, it's sort of the Lord have mercy cry, right? If we need mercy, that means that we're in a situation where we feel trapped, where we feel abandoned, and so we cry out for mercy.
Yeah, dude, it's like that Footprints in the Sand poem. You know, that's like super cheesy. That was on like your grandmother's bathroom wall or whatever. And you know, it's like, I look back at my life and I see that in the hardest times, there's only one set of footprints. What happened? And then God's like, no, like, I didn't leave you. That's when I was carrying you, which is like kind of nice and everything. Except for the fact that like, when you actually look back through your life, there's only one set of footprints. There was like never two, and you were just getting carried the whole time. Like kicking and screaming, and you were cussing God out the whole time. Where you at? Well, I'm carrying you. You're on my back right now, right here.
Yeah, there's you'll have to Google this sometime. There's a there's an alternate version of that called Butt Prints in the Sand. Well, I could quote part of it. If you're listening, just Google it sometime. Butt Prints in the Sand. It talks about how, you know, squirming and trying to get away from God, and finally he drops him a couple times, and there's butt prints in the sand.
Just drags him.
Yeah, then he picks him back up and carries him again. Yeah, so that's the cry of the sinner, I love that. I don't agree with everything that Bonhoeffer wrote, but I do like that one line where he says, "When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." Because that really is what happens. The calling of Christ is for us to die to ourselves, and that's what the Israelites are experiencing here. So they cry out. Moses responds to the people, and here's what he says. Do not fear. I read recently that is the most, numerically, the most common command in the scriptures. Do not fear. Do not be afraid.
Yeah, that's actually true. Yeah. or at least versions of it. Do not fear. Do not be afraid. There is nothing to fear. Like things like anything, any of those, you know, you can rearrange the wording. But if you take the Old and the New Testament, it's kind of shocking. It's one thing about God nothing about God changes, but you see this God talking the same way in the Old and the New Testament. Jesus says that a ton. Do not be afraid, or there is nothing to fear, or whatever it is. But yeah, he seems, God in both the Old and New Testament seems very interested in extinguishing fear.
Yeah, I hadn't really ever thought about this, but makes me wonder if that is not our one of our, you know, our fundamental daily hourly problems, is that we're afraid in one way or another. I mean, whether we're afraid of death, we're afraid of other people's disapproval, whether we're afraid of just the uncertainties of life, whatever it is, God steps up and says, look, it's all right. Don't be afraid. I'm here.
Yeah. And that's always wrapped up in a divine, I got this. I mean, it isn't as though God doesn't say like, hey, that's not scary. Oh, what, you got a couple hundred thousand dudes and chariots coming down on you?
No big deal.
Whatevs. Like, what are you afraid of? It's more like telling you that, like, you don't have to fear that he's bigger and greater than whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of my favorite passages in the Bible, which I annoy my congregation, by the way, with this, because they say that I say that about, like, every passage in the Bible. But anyway, one I like a lot anyway, is fear not, little flock. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. There's something super, gentle and reassuring about that in the midst of life in a world that's violent and has plenty to fear. That's consistent with God, that he isn't interested in you being afraid. In fact, he's very interested in you not being afraid on account of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the same thing. It's the same thing here with the Israelites. I mean, he doesn't just say don't be afraid. He says, here's what's going to happen. Here's why you shouldn't be afraid, because stand by, just stand there and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. He says, because the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever.
Yeah. In other words, God's not like, do not be afraid. You got this. He doesn't ever say that. He's not, hey, there's nothing to be afraid of. You got this. Instead, God's like, don't be afraid. Hold my beer and watch this. More like
that's a good quote. God says, hold my beer.
Hold my beer. Watch this. You got nothing to be afraid of.
That's the quote of this particular podcast. At the Red Sea, God says, hold my beer. Just watch what I'm about to happen. It's a good summary too, because Moses goes on to say, Yahweh will fight for you while you keep silent. I'm not a big fan of the paraphrase, the Message, but I was looking. I was writing something on this not very long ago, and I looked at his paraphrase of this, and it says something like, "Just shut up and watch while I save you." And that's a pretty good summary of what God is saying here. Just be silent. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. Just watch what I'm about to do for you.
Yeah. I like it when God tells me to shut my mouth and open my eyes. It's good.
Yes. It's always the best. Yeah. In connection with this, I was looking at Psalm 46. That verse says, be still and know that I am God. And the Hebrew for be still has the connotation of, like, just letting your hands hang there, or putting them in your pocket, or sitting on them. And the message is basically, don't do anything. Don't do anything with your hands. Just be still and know that I'm God. And you're going to know that I'm God when I act on your behalf. So even though you're afraid, there's really nothing that you're going to be able to do on your own that's going to save you from this. I'm going to take care of it, because God is going to fight for you while you shut up and watch. So that's the message that Moses gives to them. And then God speaks to Moses. It's kind of a weird command here. He starts out by saying, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. It's weird because there's no record that Moses was crying out to God. I think it's Luther that comments on this, that Moses, even though he must have been speaking to the Israelites as if he was full of confidence in his own heart, was crying out to God and saying, I don't know what you're about to do, but I hope you have something in mind, because we're in a really bad spot here. Whatever it is, God tells Moses, basically, I don't want you crying out to me either. You be silent, just like the Israelites are silent. And here's the only thing that I want you to say. Tell the sons of Israel to move forward. And then he says to lift up your staff. We've encountered Moses' staff many times over the course of Exodus. It's what turned into a serpent. It's what he struck the Nile River with. It's what he struck the ground with. This is God's staff, God's shepherd's crook that he uses over and over to effect punishment on the enemies of his people and deliverance for his people. So lift up your staff, stretch it over the sea, and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry ground. So checking our time here to see how much we still have a few minutes left. We can cover a little bit more. So that's the command that's given. And God tells Moses ahead of time what's going to happen. He says, I'm going to harden the heart of the Egyptians so that they pursue you, and I'll be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I'm honored through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. So that's the command that's given to Moses. We're going to wait to see the effect of this in just a minute. But there's going to be a delay. First of all, what happens is that the cloud that we heard about back in chapter 13, this pillar of cloud is going to move from in front of the Israelites to the back of the Israelites, and it's gonna be a screen or a wall between the Israelites and the Egyptians, because the Egyptians are the army is moving forward, and so that they can't attack the Israelites, God erects this wall or this barrier between the two groups of people in this pillar of cloud. So it was there all night long so that neither could come near the other all night. Moses then stretches out his hand over the sea, and God causes this east wind to blow all night long. It's not like, with a snap of his fingers, he makes this happen. The east wind blows all night, and the sea opens into dry land, so that there's like this wall of water on their left and a wall of water on their right. Now, what's happening here in many ways is we are being directed back all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. You got to read the crossing of the Red Sea from the perspective of creation. This is a great example of how creation and redemption are joined together. So God the Creator is God the Redeemer, and the way that God redeems is through the stuff of creation. So just like in Genesis chapter 1, one of the verbs that occurs over and over is to divide. So he divides this from that, the heavens above from the heavens below, the waters from dry ground. There's all these divisions going on, and we have now another division. There's the division of the Red Sea, so that you have the water and you have the dry ground. So this is God acting as the creator in order to provide a passageway for his people to work their way through. And this is sort of a rebirth or a new creation for the Israelites. You can kind of picture the crossing of the Red Sea almost as a place of new birth for the Israelites. They are leaving behind the old, and they are coming into the new. And that's the reason that the Red Sea has always, beginning already in the New Testament, been held up as the picture of what happens to us in baptism. We are born again in the water. Israel is born again in the water. They leave behind the old, and they move into the new. And as they do, all of the bad stuff from before is drowned, just like all our sins are drowned, just like the Egyptians are drowned. So all of that is destroyed in the water, and what emerges is a people who are free, who are redeemed, who are cleansed by God and ready for the new life ahead of them.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll have more to say to that point, but it'll have to wait until next week, because there's lots to say about the crossing of the Red Sea, because there's some things going to get destroyed in there too.
Yeah, we've got maybe half more of the chapter to go, so we'll stay tuned for next time. We'll pick it up with the actual crossing.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, rate and review this thing on iTunes. That helps us out, gives us more visibility, and share it with your friends and social media if you like this podcast. All that stuff it helps. In fact, that's the best way to help us out. And we appreciate all you guys downloading and listening, and we will see you next week.